Reload.
Good afternoon. The Higher Education and Workforce Development Budget Division will now be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, April 7th. Welcome back, everyone. Those who enjoyed a nice holiday break, we're now ready to, go full speed between now and end of session. So we're going to begin the day with Senator Stumpf. We're looking forward to hearing Senator Stumpf's proposal. I remember when we did our first press conference and had the first six bills, Senator Stumpf's bill was Senate File number 2, which was certainly an indication of how important we thought it was to the people of Minnesota. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And when I came in here, I thought, wow, there's quite a crowd here. And then I realized when I looked on the back side of your agenda that it's really the biannual budget that they're here for.
No way, Senator Stumpf, they're here for your bill.
Oh, well, thank you. You're right, Madam Chair. The discussion goes back to somewhere around December when I think we talked about this, and we both were interested in what the state of Tennessee was doing. And from that discussion, it has kind of evolved over quite a few weeks of discussion, trying to gather data, bringing the higher education office and their staff to play into play. And I really, I think before I start, I would really be remiss if I didn't thank you and thank your staff and thank the staff of the higher education office for all the hours that that have been put in. The people were wondering what happened to Senate File 2. We heard it, you know, there was a first of the session, and then it kind of disappeared. And it was really, the reason it took so long is that there were a lot of details and a lot of data, that calculations that we were trying to put together. The real interest, I think, that drove, for me anyway, drove the importance of Senate File 2 home was when we went around the state and looked at our bonding projects about a year and a half ago. And it seemed like every community that we went into, there were businesses that were short of skilled workers. And it just happened all over the place, in the metropolitan area as well as in all corners of the state. And the business community was struggling to try to fill those positions. And so when Tennessee came out with this idea, I think some of us thought that this would be a great way to try to address a very serious worker shortage in the state of Minnesota. And I brought along, and I realized that this is not pertaining to the bill itself, but this is a newspaper from our small, relatively small Thief River Falls community. In here, I think there's probably about roughly, about 18 pages of the total paper. But of those 18 pages, there's over 4 pages of nothing but want ads like this.
Wow.
And they just cannot find people to fill those positions. So many of the companies up there, and we have quite a few, you would think that I would be from the most agricultural part of the state. Well, in my northwest corner of the state, we have over 400 manufacturers up in that area. And a lot of them are relatively good-sized manufacturers, such as Polaris and Articat and Marvin Windows, along with a host of other manufacturers. So this is, I think, I just want to frame why I think this is such an important piece of legislation that we are, the state of Minnesota, even with its low unemployment and even with its high attendance of college, we are destined to have a severe worker shortage if we cannot pull in those people who are not going on to post-secondary education. And we have areas of those students who are out there who feel, whether it's the first, no one, they would be the first one in their family to go to college, or whether they just outright cannot afford it. I think this legislation tries to get at some of those dynamics. And so anyway, this is some of the and we've tried to get at some of those areas in a special way. What the legislation, Senate File 2, does is I think create opportunity for those students to go on and get into school, post-secondary school. And it's zeroed in on the two-year colleges. And it's zeroed in on a skill set so that those who get into the program will end up after 2 years having a skill that they can go out and find a job. And in many cases, as we traveled around the state, we'd sit down and talk to programs like the welding program out in Dakota Tech College, or the CNC program up in Staples. Many of these programs are really highly paid positions that are gained, and skills are gained in a two-year program, or in some cases even less. So I think that this legislation, which allows it's relatively simple, but it allows those students to go to a two-year program, gain a skill, and have their tuition and fees paid for. I think what I should do is maybe I could run through. It's not that not that long, but maybe run through the legislation quickly.
And Senator Stump, do you want to offer the amendment?
Oh yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A8 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's the
A9.
Yep. So Senator Sharon moves the A9. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
And just for the record, there is a quorum.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, the Section 1 is the definitions, and as I mentioned, it's for Minnesota residents that attend a two-year college in Minnesota, and they have to be a resident to be eligible. It also brings in those students that have a GED certificate or diploma, and also the ABE diploma, and those two areas tend to be, I think they will add to the diversity that we are kind of looking for. I think that's it'll be a benefit, I think, to a larger extent to those students. The process, obviously, is that they have to go through and file a application for the free application for federal student aid, and they will. There is an exemption for not entering right after graduation, and that exemption is for the AmeriCorps workers. And the reason for that is that AmeriCorps generally, I think, has the AmeriCorps workers go out and do their work first before they get a credit to go to college. And so as you see later on, that process subtracts that credit from what the state would put in terms of this grant. But income limits, which would normally have been the grant limits, which are under current law, would be. I believe it's, where they fall off the. The grant limits here, the income limits for the families, have been raised to $125,000,
And then, of course, the process, as I mentioned, in subdivision, I think six. I don't have an actual, I have the A8, so. I'm just hoping that it hasn't changed.
If our page could please give Senator Stump the A9. Thank you. We have a new page. Her name is Coley.
Thank you very much. And they have to have a, they're eligible under this program to do up to 72 semester credits, and that they would end up having to have a grade point average of 2.5 at the end of the first year, and also at the end of the second year. The credit load is 30 credits. And then the renewal process for that grant, if there is no basically a prorating, if there is not enough money, it's the first the ones that are in the program, and then also the ones that have the earliest date of filing an application. And then a very key part of the program is the mentorship of the program. And we've talked often about how important the mentorship is, both for teachers, but also for counselors in our schools. And also in Tennessee, their program talked about the reason their program is really working out and successful is because of the mentorship aspect to their program. And here, what we want to see is really a support-type person who will stay in communication with these students on a very frequent basis, and someone that can help them spell out their personalized study plan and be involved with them in terms of on-campus resources and personal development and financial planning. And then I think that will assure a much higher rate of success for these students than if we did not have that as part of the part of the program. The reporting that comes back is, I think, important as well. And it's important for the justification of spending this money for the program. It's also important, I think, to gather the information to see how the program might be changed or improved if it is successful. It'll give us an indication of how this program is actually working. The cost of the program, we have someone here from the Higher Education Office that'll go through the fiscal note, but the cost in the first year is a little over $9 million, and in the second year, a little over $15 million. And the mentorship program is about $2.7 million over the biennium. So I think, Madam Chair and members, maybe this would be a good point where we can go through the fiscal note and then maybe address questions or whatever concerns the committee might have.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Meredith Burgess. I'm with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I assisted in preparing the fiscal note. So just walking through the fiscal note, I'm not quite sure where to start. So I'm actually going to have you flip to page 7, which is the OHE portion, and then we'll return to the front. So page 7. And what you see there is the summarized cost for the program that Senator Stump just walked through. On page 8, what you'll see is those costs are differentiated We did provide costs for both. Well, they're not differentiated there. We did provide costs for both the grant program explicitly plus the mentoring costs. What we note under the assumptions is that this is essentially referenced in that as a tuition relief fund, which was one of the original names. So my apologies, it's not the current name. Which assumes that it's tuition fees minus Pell Grant plus state grant plus the AmeriCorps scholarship. It is a last dollar in program. We will be using actual tuition fees charged by the institution, taking into account the student's enrollment level. So if they're enrolled for 12 credits or 14, that is the level of tuition that will be used. It is available year-round for fall, spring, and summer terms. And in the original fiscal note, it was limited to 60 credits of its enrollment. But now I understand with the A9 amendment that for the two-year programs that specifically extend to 72, we are providing that 72-credit limit for those programs. In terms of recipient population, we are basing the estimate on recent high school graduates. OHE does not have high school graduation in our current database readily available, so we used an age approximation to get that number. We do not have an accurate estimate of how many ABE or GED recipients would qualify, so that is not in our recipient pool, nor AmeriCorps deferments. In addition, we used actual enrollment data, which included the students, whether they were attending a Minsky State College and whether they were in one of the majors that is specified under the definition of program, which is a Carl D. Perkins program. In addition, we assume that all students eligible will complete a FAFSA. And for those students who don't currently complete a FAFSA, they will likely be incentivized to complete a FAFSA. For enrollment level, OHE used the 30 credits or more definition, and we looked at historical enrollment patterns and noted that 30% of eligible students currently complete 30 credits or more. In terms of renewal rates, we did assume that about 30% of students will not have their funds renewed because they fall below the GPA requirement or will have completed their program in the first year. So in terms of on the bottom of page 9, what you see is the table of recipients. We're currently estimating that approximately 2,034 students will qualify in the first year. In the second year, we'll have an additional 1,400 students who renew their grant for a total of 3,464 students. Moving to page 10, what we show are the costs for those. The tuition relief dollars would be approximately $7.2 million in year one. The renewal grants will add an additional $5.1 million. And then the total cost for mentoring is provided on a per student basis, and the administrative cost for mentoring was set at approximately $800. In terms of total costs, we also include administrative costs for OHE. In the amount of $100,000 for staffing, an initial startup IT cost of $125,000. Ongoing, it's $100,000 for staffing and $25,000 for ongoing IT costs. So the total is $9.1 million in year one, $15.25 in year two, which is the total cost for fiscal year 16-17 of $24.4 million. In addition, it's noted that Minsky also completed a fiscal note for this program. That is what you will find on pages 3 through 6. The one thing that's important to note in the Minsky fiscal note is while OHE is doing a baseline estimate on the program, depending on how it's advertised, may actually incentivize students to change their behavior. More of them may choose to enroll in a career and technical ed program as opposed to an associate transfer program, or may choose to enroll at a state college in a career and technical ed program as opposed to a state university or a private college or the University of Minnesota. So depending on how those behaviors change, the number of recipients may grow. But that is, again, dependent upon advertising and students' perception of availability of the program. So that's a lot of detail. Is there something more specific you'd like me to address?
Questions from the members? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Stumpf, I'm looking at the eligibility in the A9, and it talks about those students coming in immediately after secondary school graduation or completing an ABE program or GED. So I'm thinking about students, a couple that I know, who have decided to go to follow a technical college career. They maybe spent a year at a community college, realized that wasn't the right path for them, they would not be eligible, as I understand it. And also, if we're talking about displaced workers, those who have a skill set, have been laid off, maybe even long-term unemployed, looking to get into these fields, they wouldn't be included either. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator, that is correct. The trigger in this is that we're trying to get those the students right after they graduate, and it's not really kind of a retraining program, which we I guess to some extent a retraining program.
And Senator Pratt, the Earn While You Learn program, which will, you know, also be before us in the higher ed bill, will take those students into account. They would have to get hired by the company, but that's exactly who that provision would be targeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's fine. Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stumpf, on page 2, line 14, it says a grant is available for up to 72 semester credits. I'm wondering why we're at 72 and not 60.
Senator Stumpf.
Madam Chair and Senator Miller, it is my understanding that one of the career and technical programs offered under Minsky, which fits under the Carl D. Perkins definition, is, and I'm looking at Ms. Weidman because we just discussed this, is the Associate of Applied Science, which does require 72 program credits to complete that program.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stumpf, on the first page where we talk about eligibility, one of the topics that we've worked on here in the past several weeks is developmental education or co-requisite courses. And I'm wondering how those fit in the formula. Students that have been deemed not college ready and that will be placed in remedial courses or developmental courses, where does that fit into the picture as far as funding and credits earned?
Senator Stumpf.
Question. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Claussen. If I understand your question, are these students that have graduated with a certificate?
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, these would be students that have graduated from high school, but when taking placement exams may not have passed. So they're being placed in developmental courses or remedial courses before they can actually go into credit-bearing courses.
In college.
In the two-year college system, yes.
In some of the discussions we had, certainly the mentorship aspect of it comes to play in some of this. Depending on how many remedial courses they would have to have, let's say if it's one course, it might be a whole lot different than if it was several courses. I think the mentor would have a responsibility to try to work with that student to be sure that they're getting the best resources from that college or institution, and that they can. Doesn't say anything about.
Madam Chair and Senator Claussen.
Ms. Fergus.
It is my understanding from OHE's read of the bill that developmental education credits would be covered as they are covered under the state grant program currently. However, if those developmental education credits impede the students accumulating 30 program credits in the first year, they may not qualify for a renewal grant in year two.
Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think that's a bit concerning since we have about 28% of our students that are taking developmental courses. So this might be something that we want to explore a little bit more. And do those credits count towards 72, the total? But I think this is an area maybe we could talk a little bit more about. And I I am working on the bill that you've heard earlier on developmental coursework, and maybe we can look at that bill and look at what we're doing here and come to some kind of a conclusion on these courses. Thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Stump? Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this may be directed towards Ms. Fergus, too, because it's dealing with the fiscal note, and I know you're trying to anticipate how many more students may be applying for the two-year institutions because of this program. And it's obvious that, I was reading that the Tennessee Promise, which it's kind of based on, saw a substantial increase that went beyond anything they were anticipating. In your, I guess, calculations, did you anticipate a significant increase in the number of students that would be applying and possibly going into a two-year institution? I mean, I can see a number of students who probably would be planning to go to a four-year that might now plan to go to a two-year for the first 2 years if they have this option available. So there could be a significant number of students that shift from the four-year to the two-year as well.
Madam Chair and Senator Eakin, we have had many, many discussions about the impact of the Tennessee Promise on enrollment in state colleges in Tennessee. And we do know anecdotally that it did draw students from their state universities to their state colleges. The interesting thing in calculating out a fiscal note is when you look at the bigger picture, what likely will happen is tuition fees is lower at a state college, and given the level of a Pell Grant, it could be in making that move from a state university to a state college that Pell Grant actually covers their full tuition and fees, at which point this program would not incur a cost, an added cost. However, if the student's income is such that they're a higher income student than they move from a state university to a state college, they actually may be only receiving these program funds, at which point it would add to the cost. So the short answer is we couldn't quite come to a conclusion on what the fiscal impact would be simply because there's not enough information out there. There's too many theories that it could impact it. It could actually not have an impact on the final cost, or it could have an impact on the final cost. We just don't know at this point. And we are still trying to ascertain from Tennessee if they have firmer data on what their enrollment shifts were. The other thing to keep in mind in that, if the student moves from a four-year institution to a two-year institution, it is likely their state grant is going to decrease. So even though you see an increase in spending within this particular program, you might see a decrease in the overall state grant program. So there could be some modifying effects in the bigger picture.
Okay. And
Senator Eakin.
And Madam Chair, and Ms. Ferguson, in Tennessee, where it did occur, did it create much disruption with the four-year colleges that as far as the resulting reduction in enrollment?
Madam Chair and Senator Eakin, yes, we do. Again, we don't have firm data from Tennessee, but our understanding is there was a drop in enrollments at the state university.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was the Tennessee program also limited to those just graduating from high school?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe so. I'm trying to think who we've. I'm trying to remember the details. I'm looking at Ms. Henderson from OHE. We believe it was. She's shaking her head. Yes,
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I'm concerned that the bill has the right purpose in mind. I mean, I really like what you're doing, but I'm afraid we're serving the same population we're already serving and not reaching a new population of folks that haven't considered going to college, but would be capable of going to college or to a program like this and succeeding and educating themselves and participating in a different level in the workforce. I think we're missing that entire group of folks that have never attended college before but are capable. Do you have thoughts on that, Senator Stump? Would it just grow to be impossibly unaffordable?
Senator Stump.
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, I think the discussion that we had where we looked at where we included the GED and the ABE as a diploma to go to college, I think is a effort to try to open up the diversity of this program and or add to the diversity of this program. And I think the basically those were the discussions that we had. I do think that there is a block of students out there that even with a good state aid program and a federal Pell Grant program that just feel they just can't go to college because of the cost. And some of it, I think, is generated because they're probably the first-time college goer in their families. And some of it is, I think, more just kind of the cultural discussions about the large cost of going to college. And so I think the reason for the initial initial application right out of high school to get them started is to address that so that once students break that pattern, fewer and fewer go on to school. So if you can go from high school to college, you're more likely going to be graduating from college than if you take a couple years off. And so I think what we're trying to do is to get those students that are not going on to college into an effort to go to post-secondary education.
Ms. Fergus, if somebody goes to the military for 2 years or whatever, and do they have within their GI current benefits the ability to have grants for college, or would that be something that we might consider?
Madam Chair, yes, there are current veterans benefits as well as Minnesota GI Bill benefits that do assist service members or veterans in paying for college. That said, it is my understanding based on the language that they don't get a specific exemption within this program for military service.
Ms. Fergus, but based on your response, perhaps they don't need to because they're covered in a different capacity.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Klassen, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe in the past when we've had states that have looked at expanding state grants, or in the state of California when they had open tuition for their community colleges in Arizona as well, that they extended that residency requirement. And I'm just wondering, was that a consideration in developing the bill? And what is the residency requirement then for students that fall under Senate File 2?
Ms. Fergus?
Madam Chair and Senator Klassen, yes, military service members who are stationed in Minnesota do qualify as Minnesota residents, as do veterans who move here. I'm trying to remember the exact definition in statute. It should be in 136A.101, but I would have to check with our staff on that.
Okay, Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just talking about a student that from Wisconsin that moves to Minnesota for the purpose of going to school. I'm just wondering, was there consideration given about our current residency status and extending that for students that are coming from other states? And I, quite honestly, I'm not aware what are the residency requirements in the state of Minnesota right now to become a resident.
And I think Mr. Fuller actually has an answer on that. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Senator Klassen, if you look at the qualifications on 1.10 is a resident, and then you'll see that down at the bottom, to the online 1.21, that we pick up the definitions of the current state grant program. So under the current state grant program, there's about 8 criteria to become a resident. One is that you have to not be moving to Minnesota for the purpose of higher education. You have to be here for a year, and you can't take more than 5 credits. So that would apply to this program as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stump, you have a nice comprehensive bill here, and I want to just call out a couple things that I think are really important, and then I have one consideration that I'd like you to address. First, I think it's terrific that you are recognizing the potential with adult basic education graduates and GED graduates. And I really appreciate that those are called out and included in this proposal. And then also, I thought it was very innovative and important that you included the exception for AmeriCorps workers. Our AmeriCorps workers do a terrific job, and they our Reading Corps, for example, that is run by AmeriCorps workers, has won national acclaim. And so I'm glad that we're continuing to encourage that, and we know it provides great training as well. Full disclosure, I sit on the Serve Minnesota Board, which is the state arm of AmeriCorps. But regardless, I think it's a great to include that and encourage that. My question for you deals with the skills gap. So there's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that Minnesota has this skills gap. The skills that students are coming out of college with are not really aligned with the job vacancies. And so my question is, how does I appreciate the fact that you're looking at the Perkins eligible classification of instructional programs, but I can't tell by looking at this list, you know, I don't know, how does this list of programs that would qualify align with the gap that we have in skills? And I'm just wondering, as a policymaker, if there's any way to try and align our higher education scholarships or this 2-year tuition to actually where the skills gaps are.
And Senator Nelson, just in luck, we happen to have Mr. Hines going to join us to answer that important question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Steve Hine. I'm the research director at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I did come prepared today with some short comments that, among other things, would address this question. And if with your approval, perhaps I could just proceed through that and then readdress questions that might arise from that.
Very good.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on this proposal, the opportunities that Senate File 2 presents to us from a labor market perspective. I'd like to frame my remarks in terms of a few of the biggest challenges that our state's economy is going to be facing in the coming years and that this bill has the potential to address. Let me begin by discussing two interrelated challenges. One broader challenge that we have been facing and will continue to face is the fact that over the past few years and for the next 15 years, our labor force is going to grow at a much slower rate than we've been accustomed to. To put that in some empirical context, throughout the late 1980s and the 1990s, Minnesota averaged an annual increase in its labor force of over 43,000. Since 2000, that rate of increase has dropped to just over 8,000. And in the coming decade or so, we anticipate that this will fall even further to around 4,000 a year. And that's only if recent downward trends in various age cohort participation rates begin to stabilize and reverse. So to put that in some context, we'll be adding as many additional workers in the coming decade as we have typically added during the course of a year, 15 to 25 years ago. In short, we're on the verge of an economy whose growth will be impeded by extremely tight labor market conditions. And it will be an economy with sustained shortages in many occupational areas, including many that are vital, well-paying, and high-skilled areas. At the same time that we're facing these labor force constraints and that they are becoming increasingly binding on our ability to grow, we face an environment in which many subgroups within our population are not afforded the same opportunities for rewarding employment outcomes that the rest of us face. Our youth, our populations of color, and many with socioeconomic histories of intergenerational poverty are confronted with barriers to gainful employment, many of which stem from similar barriers to the educational opportunities necessary for gainful employment. I can't go anywhere without throwing out some numbers, so let me do that. Our average unemployment rate for black Minnesotans last year was 11.3%. The corresponding rate for white Minnesotans was 3.3%. We had historically had the worst ratio in terms of those measures until Wisconsin leapt ahead of us, bless them. but still, nonetheless, a serious issue. And with respect to the educational discrepancies between them, let me look at the 2013 American Community Survey. The proportion of white Minnesotans with an Associate of Arts degree or more by that data was 45.1%. The corresponding rate for black Minnesotans was 28.1%, and for Hispanics it was 16.8%. So it's also the case that here again, our future trends are projected to dramatically increase our state's racial and ethnic diversity, which only makes it that much more important that these imbalances be addressed. So it is imperative that these barriers be overcome if we're to meet the challenges that a slowly growing labor force will put before us in the years ahead. Providing individuals, especially those from these disadvantaged but growing subgroups, with the wherewithal to fully engage in the educational employment opportunities that our state has to offer would go a long way in meeting these severe challenges that we're going to be facing. In addition, I noted that the future will very likely bring widespread shortages of individuals with the education and skills employers will need. The skills gap, as it's often referred to. In such an environment, it's crucial that the scarce worker pool we have be allocated to those areas that yield the highest return. If we consider that our state's aggregate income, the basis for our material well-being, our standard of living, is a product of the workers we have and the amount that each of these workers can produce, that is their productivity, all right, we've noted the importance of removing barriers to entry into the workforce. But just as crucial is the employing of each of these individuals in their most productive capacity. Clearly, improving an individual's skill set through access to the educational opportunities that Senate File 2 provides would make them more employable and more productive. But we must also ensure that these educational opportunities align with the occupational areas that will provide the best employment outcomes. And it's important to recognize that not all educational programs are equal in this respect. For example, recent Associate of Arts degree graduates in engineering technology programs earned a median annual wage of nearly $40,000 2 years after graduation, and two-thirds of them were employed full-time, while performing arts grads earned $17,000 on median, and fewer than one-third were full-time. Nice. Now, that's not to suggest that some areas should be supported and others not, or that those with a dream of being a performing artist should not be allowed to pursue that dream, but rather that solid information and good counseling regarding the likely outcomes available through various fields of study will allow a self-selection into those areas that offer the highest rate of return. So in conclusion, we're entering a time when full utilization of our most important resource, our top-notch workforce here in Minnesota, is crucial to our future well-being as a state. This full utilization requires ensuring widespread access to the educational background and required by the jobs of the future, especially for those communities that have historically experienced barriers to this access. It also requires that the educational offerings of our higher ed institutions be well aligned with the occupational areas offering the best opportunities. And here, I think that intensive career guidance and reliable information on the relative merits of various educational programs are crucial to success. Again, I see that happening through a self-selection. Individuals, if given a choice between a well-paying opportunity and a not so well-paying opportunity, I think we'll see that self-selection occur. So the proposal in Senate File 2, I think it's much like the Power of You program that's still conducted here in the Twin Cities, can be an effective mechanism in meeting the challenges of the future head-on if strategically implemented. Thank you. Now I'll return to your question regarding skill gaps. Do you want to?
Sure.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hine, you always give us good numbers and information. I appreciate that. So, yeah, so my question, you did touch on it, which really has to do with how do we align the two-year public college tuition paid two-year public college with the skills gap or the jobs that we exist. And I did notice that you talked about the institutions doing that aligning, and so that's one level. But when it comes to students selecting then which courses they're going to take, I wonder, I didn't see anything in the language about the mentoring or anything in the bill that actually directs and calls out specifically that counseling regarding, it talks about success planning. But
Senator Nelson, are you working off the A9?
I am.
Okay,
but
good.
I don't see anything that talks in the mentoring about specifically helping students understand the alignment with jobs that are available and different levels of pay. For example, performing artists was a very interesting statistic, $17,000 annual salary, one-third of them are full-time employed. I think it's important that students get that information as they're looking at which degree program to pursue. And I don't see anything in the bill that actually addresses that, but maybe I'm missing something.
Well, Senator Nelson, I would also direct your eyes towards lines 2.31 and 2.32, where it says the plan must include concrete steps towards program completion and job placement, and identify and make continue. So perhaps that would be where you'd want to beef that up. But
yes.
Senator Stumpf?
Exactly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson. Yes, we were trying to not be as blatantly open saying you have to go into this program or that program.
I don't want to say that.
But we tried to address the need to be successful in those programs and to be sure that the student has a successful plan. We're not directive, but the last point is financial planning. So I think all of those things are kind of fitting together.
Just a final comment.
Senator Nelson.
So I do appreciate that, although I personally would like to see it called out more specifically, because I think when we use targeted public dollars, there's always a high competition for those dollars. I think it's important that as policymakers, we help incent that the students actually are being aware of what those job prospects are. And financial planning is really a rather broad term. It could mean a lot of things. And so I do like the word job placement in there, but and success is critically important. But even if a student is highly successful and graduates on time, but let's just say they graduate in accordion repair. That's going to be a tough area, or buggy whips. We don't make those anymore here. I'm just being facetious, but the point is we want students to graduate in those careers that have jobs at the end of them, and so that's just something that going forward I would like to see better called out.
And Senator Nelson, perhaps it would be possible to add just a couple sentences about must include job placement and wage data.
Yes, and maybe staff can help
Mr.
align
Fuller.
That for me. Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, under current law, 136F37, the board of trustees of MINSTU must assess labor market data when conducting college program reviews. Colleges, which is what we're talking about in this bill, must provide students with the job placement rate for graduates of technical and occupational programs offered at the colleges. So I would suggest that we would amend that law instead, because that applies to people beyond those who are in this program, so the whole audience is there. I'm not familiar with what is being done now, but there is an obligation. I'm not sure it's being met, but it's in the law, and that would be an appropriate place to put it.
Right.
And then in addition, there is an outreach provision in the bill with recruitment and promotion, and I assume as part of that obligation, they would be pointing to those courses that would be beneficial. They'd be using this data, and we could put it there as well.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. So we'll work on that between now
and. And one final thing, if we could just add, Madam Chair, that it also include a wage range. I don't think the current language includes that. Thank you very much.
Ms. Fergus, and then Senator Klassen.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, Carl D. Perkins programs are already under federal requirements to publish placement rate and employment rate data for their placement, their participants. Most of that data is actually found on the iSeek website currently, so anyone can look up now what the various placement and employment information is for those programs.
Thank you. Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fergus, if I remember correctly, too, for the Minsky programs, they have certain requirements as far as placement or in order to be a viable program. Those programs are dropped if the assessment of placement and so on, other criteria is not met.
Madam Chair and Senator Klassen, I believe you are correct, but I'm kind of looking at my Minsky colleagues for confirmation.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Linda Milne. I am Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And you'll excuse me, Chair. I was out of the room, so I didn't hear the question. Just came back.
Ms. Milne, the question was if the Perkins, well, I'll let you restate it, Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I remember correctly, in order for Minsky programs to be viable, they have to meet certain requirements as far as placement and other criteria, or those programs are phased out.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Klassen. Through our academic programs approval process, we review what are the job placement opportunities for students in the area, what other programs are available in the area, what are the salaries and wages available for the position, for the positions coming out of those programs.
Thank you. Well, Senator Stumpf, it's a very big bill, and I think an important one, and really does make a statement to our students how important we think it is that they do participate in post-secondary education and that they consider where the jobs are, so that they consider being in those programs that will, in fact, lead them to fulfilling careers.
Are there more testifiers?
I don't think there are. Were there other testifiers, Senator Stumpf?
I don't think so.
Somebody on the other.
And was there anybody else who would like to speak on behalf of the bill? Our student leader.
Madam Chair, I actually have a statement from the commissioner.
Oh, please do.
Commissioner Pogemiller, of course, couldn't be here today, and so I'm stepping back into my OHE staff role as opposed to fiscal note preparer role. So OHE, as you know, our priorities are always for need-based financial aid for all students. That is always our priority. So in this case, it would be for the state grant program. And we kind of like to remind the committee that programs such as these are successful because we do have adequate funding of the Pell Grant and the state grant in Minnesota. So it's important to keep in mind how we fund the various programs to ensure that this one would be as successful as well.
Thank you. Kaylee.
Chair Bonoff, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kaylee Schoonmaker. I'm the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. And I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak today on Senate File 2. We're really excited about it. Over the past decade, students attending our public, community, and technical colleges have seen a sharp increase in costs and in tuition. And according to data from the Chronicle of Higher Education Almanac Edition, students attending our colleges pay the third highest tuition and fees in the country when compared to like institutions. And as tuition has risen, students have been faced with the harsh reality of covering large cost increases every year. For many, it's meant taking fewer credits each semester so that they can work more hours. And for others, it's meant increased student loan debt. And for some, it's been a combination of those two. As we have heard several times in this committee during this session, when students aren't able to maximize the number of credits that they take, their likelihood of graduation decreases. We believe that financial strain and the need to work more hours are key factors in how a student decides on how many credits to take. Over the past few years, students have enjoyed the benefits of a tuition freeze that was passed in the last budget session, and that has allowed them a break from the seemingly endless increases in tuition of the past decade. We're thankful to the legislature and the governor for recognizing the important role that our colleges play in Minnesota's future and for prioritizing college affordability. The legislation before you today, Senate File 2 as amended, is just one more example of prioritizing students and highlighting the important role that our two-year community and technical colleges play in strengthening Minnesota's economy. Senate File 2 as amended will bring much-needed financial assistance to students who want to pursue certain technical programs. And by providing students with assistance to cover unmet need after financial aid, the state would be investing in students who will get a quality education and will be able to move directly into the workforce. By removing the financial barrier of tuition, students will be able to take more credits and will have an easier time completing their degree in a timely manner. They will also be able to graduate with minimal or no student loan debt. This is a win for students, parents, and for our economy. We want to offer our sincere gratitude to Senator Stump for introducing Senate File 2 and for allowing this great discussion to happen around the importance of affordability and technical education. We know that affordable and accessible community and technical colleges will play an important role in helping our state thrive into the future. Senate File 2 and other investments into our colleges this session will undoubtedly provide great benefits to our state as a whole. Madam Chair and members, thank you again for the opportunity. We're thankful again to be part of this important conversation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Shoemaker. Ms. Shoemaker. Very good. So with that, we'll lay the bill over as amended and have it be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Now we'll move to 1692 of Senator Sieben. I believe I've seen her. There she is. Yep. And members, we do have the room beyond four, so if it does go after, I wouldn't expect that it would go much past quarter or five. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1692 is an appropriation for the University of Minnesota to establish a regenerative medicine research grant. So the money that we are proposing to appropriate to the university would provide funding to expand the regenerative medicine research program. The funding would allow the institute to create new research positions, which would attract and retain researchers at the university. In addition to salary, each researcher would have funding available for lab startup costs and to hire staff. I do have an amendment that I was wondering if a member would please move for me. It's the A2 amendment. As members will see, it's language that clarifies the what the expenses could be used for. It also drops the cost of the appropriation down fairly significantly from $7.5 million to $1.5 million.
So Senator Sharon moves the A2. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, upon completing their degrees, students at the university don't have opportunities available to them at other research institutes for furthering their careers. So additional positions at the Regenerative Medicine Institute would provide the opportunity for students who studied at the university to remain there and continue to do this good work. Expanding regenerative medicine research in our state builds off of the investments we have made in previous years. And Madam Chair, you have been a big supporter of that in the past, and I thank you so much for that. But regenerative medicine, I think, is an emerging field that's very exciting. And here with me today to offer testimony is a real genius in this field, Dr. Jacob Toller. He's a shining light in Minnesota and has been collaborating with the Mayo Clinic to expend some of the grants that we've appropriated in the past for this regenerative medicine research. And now he's here today to talk about this bill.
Very good. Welcome, Dr. Toller. So nice to have you back before our committee. So please share your testimony on Senator Stevens' bill, as well as update the committee on anything you'd like with regard to what we appropriated last biennium.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Stevens, it's a pure delight to be here today. I'm Dr. Jacob Toller. I'm a bone marrow transplant physician. I work at the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital. My job is treating children with cancer, with other life-threatening disorders, and I also have the honor of serving as a director of the Stem Cell Institute at the University of Minnesota and as a co-chair of Regenerative Minnesota, Regenerative Medicine in Minnesota. So to really understand where we are at, and with deep gratitude for everything that you have supported and thought about, it is almost inevitable that everyone in this room will be touched by the transformative treatments that come from regenerative medicine in similar way as you have been and I have been touched by foundational advance in medicine in the past. Think of antibiotics, antiseptics, surgeries. In the same way, the regenerative medicine will fill in the gap that we are feeling right now, because we have achieved a lot with the medicine as it is, but we have not really overcome the ceiling of many disorders that we are not able to treat. So the regenerative medicine is a fulfillment of an ancient medical dream of using cells of your body and my body to harness the power to rejuvenate, to repair, to replace the parts that are dysfunctional, missing, or damaged by injury. And we are uniquely positioned to do this. The University of Minnesota has been on the forefront of pioneering research in stem cell biology and regenerative medicine for the last 50 years. The first ever stem cell therapy has been the first ever successful bone marrow transplantation done in Minneapolis in 1968. And we have been advancing as fast as we can, and we are today at a point when we can take skin cells from any one of you. If there is a need to gene correct them, we can do that. We can transform these cells into the cells that can be the parents, if you will, of differentiated cells of any part of the body and can serve that repair, regenerate, rejuvenate function that I mentioned before. So why I'm here? The reason is that there are many patients that have no time to wait until we achieve this at the current pace. Many Minnesotans will die of disorders that are open to regenerative medicine, such as Alzheimer's, heart disease, diabetes, spinal cord injury, severe burns, while waiting for the translation to happen from the discovery to the clinical bedside. So very importantly, we ask that you consider funding for the researchers and you accelerate the pace at which we are moving at the moment. The great minds that we can get here into Minneapolis, St. Paul, are nationally available. I know from my personal experience that people are attracted to the Stem Cell Institute, to the University of Minnesota, but we just don't have the funds to recruit them and keep them here. So as Senator Sieben has said, this funding is aimed at keeping the best of the best in the United States, but relocating them into the University of Minnesota. Because by having the critical mass of great minds, I am no genius, but they may be, here they will be able to cross-pollinate their ideas, they will be able to recharge the batteries, if you will, of the researchers that are here already. They will create jobs, and they will advance the pace at which we have to move with regenerative medicine. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the reason I am here is that the pace at which we are moving has to advance, in my opinion, because there are people on behalf of whom I am here that cannot, that are patients, current or future, that cannot be here today, but they will need this advance. And perhaps even you will, and I am here on your behalf, so that we can accelerate the pace of regenerative medicine at the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Dr. Tolar, thank you so much. I think I shared this the last time we had this discussion, but last Friday, I had the Passover Seder at my home, and my cousin was seated at the table, and she had been diagnosed with a fatal disease. It was a particular type of cancer, and so she did undergo complete immune stem cell transplant, and she has been great for 3 years. She was wonderful on Friday, and all clear. So,
Madam Chair, I wish her the best. This is how successful regenerative medicine looks like.
Yeah, thank you very much. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Tolar, thank you for the great testimony. Senator Seaman, this regenerative medicine is such an exciting area. I do believe it is the medicine of tomorrow, today. And I see it as, I think, Senator Seaman, you mentioned, really building on the past successes that we have done. You know, probably 12, 14 years ago, we established the genomic partnership between Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, looking at that genome structure, and now looking at regenerative medicine, kind of that second step, taking what we've learned and then being able to actually form the cures with our own cells. So it's very exciting. I do have a question, and that is, I know last year we did fund the regenerative medicine through the partnership, and so that involves both of our research institutions, our flagship institutions in the state, the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic. And so I'm looking at this bill here and seeing that it only is including one of those institutions. And I didn't know if I could talk with Senator Seaman offline, but had there been discussion to continue that partnership and include both of our flagship institutions in actually funding the number of medical researchers to continue on discovering and pushing the regenerative medicine forward.
Senator Seaman. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson for that question. The regenerative medicine funding that we approved in the last biennium is an ongoing appropriation, and it's I'm hopeful that through this legislative session, that funding will continue. So I am fairly confident in that the funding for the work that Dr. Tolar and Dr. Terzig from the Mayo Clinic are co-chairing that partnership to give out grants to other researchers to do regenerative medicine research will continue. This initiative, Senate File 1692, is a little bit different in that it's actually funding researchers at the University of Minnesota to do regenerative medicine research. And the reason why I thought that it was best to move forward in this direction was severalfold. The first being that I think, and having toured the Dr. Tolar's research that he's doing, that having that collaboration among scientists or medical doctors or Dr. Tolar can talk about all the different work that's being done. Having that done in one location is beneficial for the cross-pollination of ideas and the advancement of the work. Further, I think that having the University of Minnesota as our state's driving research institution, it makes sense to house that at the University of Minnesota. So it's not that I still fully support, I carry the bill for the regenerative medicine partnership between the Mayo and the University of Minnesota. But I think that this is a way to move forward with this bill. And Dr. Toler, do you want to add anything?
Madam Chair,
Senator Toler.
Senator Nelson, thank you very much for that introductory, you know, compliment. It really goes on behalf of the whole partnership, the Regenerative Medicine Minnesota, which again, as Senator Seaman said, is co-chaired by Mayo Clinic and University of Minnesota. And we are immensely proud of the already first year of achievements. We've been able to allocate the funds that you have been so kind to provide to the best science there is, to educational efforts for the most talented people, you know, that are in the regenerative medicine space. And again, you know, we see this as a huge opening, a beautiful opening, and as you said, a new horizon in medicine in general. To comment on the collaborative efforts that are ongoing at the University of Minnesota and on the slightly different tangent of this current legislation that we are discussing, it is almost impossible to have hiring people at two different institutions. So we respect deeply everything that's being done at Mayo Clinic, and we are collaborating with them intensely and with enormous, you know, energy. But if there is a person or people that need to be hired into an intellectual cluster, they need to see each other. They need to talk to each other. They have to have a space that Senator Seaban has visited where their ideas recombine, and that synergy from daily contact and daily presentations will create what we seek, which is the higher quality regenerative medicine that we want here in Minnesota.
Just one follow-up.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So how does this, aside from the fact that it's one institution instead of two, but how does the, what's the difference then between the ongoing funding, which funds grants for research, I assume, competitive research grants, what's the difference between that then and this particular proposal, which just directly funds medical researchers?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, the regenerative medicine bill that was passed before, as you said, gives grants to researchers or to educational projects and to undergraduate students in biology with a focus on regenerative medicine. So that is smaller-based grants to do regenerative medicine work. The bill that's before us would fund the hiring of several researchers and their staff to be almost like a, I think of it, and I don't know if this is quite right, but I think of it as like a professor position at the university, not necessarily, well, I don't know if
that's right.
Okay, so to be almost like a professor position where they'd be a faculty, where they would have a team of researchers surrounding them and do that, run a lab and do that research.
And Senator Nelson, right now what's being passed out is what we have currently learned that the bill that we've previously appropriated has gone towards. So you can see the kind of activities. And what you can notice as you read through it is it's does not refer to personnel in any way. So what Senator Stevens brought forward is to actually be a separate support of personnel, just like in the governor's budget. The governor proposed $30 million, and that was also in Senator Cohn's bill, to go towards the university's medical school to give them the ability to hire those types of researchers. So I think we might think of this as perhaps one of the pieces within that $30 million would go towards hiring this type of personnel. And so while I haven't talked to the Mayo Clinic about this particular bill, they have let us know that they're very much in support of the governor's proposal, and actually we've understood they've sent a letter that we haven't yet received saying that.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm very well aware of their great support for that
great
initiative from the
Thank
governor
you.
As well.
Good. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Seaman or Dr. Toler, you're doing some fascinating work, and I've been enthralled with the accomplishments you've had. But we do have, but I do notice in the bill that it's an appropriation to the Board of Regents, and we have a fairly autonomous Board of Regents and a university system that's brought to us you know, $100 million request, and I don't recall this being a part of it. What was your, have you approached the Board of Regents and the university leadership about this? My concern being is that in some ways we're kind of micromanaging the Board of Regents and their strategies with this bill, and maybe you can help me understand that a little bit more.
Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, this is not a formal part of the University of Minnesota's Board of Regents budget request. This bill is not. On the other hand, in discussions with various university officials, including President Kaler, who knew that I was, you know, carried the regenerative medicine bill in the past, and he's very supportive of, certainly supportive of Dr. Toler's work and was supportive of it. It's not part of their formal request. With that being said, I think that it wouldn't be an unwelcome appropriation to the university.
And there, if anyone from the university would like to approach the table, anyone from the university? I don't think so. Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes,
Senator
Dr.
Pratt,
Toa.
If I can add to this, the bottom line, the really bluntness of this is that the talent on the professor level that we educate at the University of Minnesota at Mayo Clinic, they leave to the coasts, and we lose them. If we want to keep the top talent in Minnesota in the space of regenerative medicine, and if I have a talented individual from Stanford, from Boston University, you know, from other places, and I want them here because they are relevant to the problem that we face, and they will, their work will translate into better health of Minnesotans. We need some funding to recruit them. We don't need more that they will get elsewhere. We just need to be in a ballpark.
And Senator Prep, we have gone back and asked the mm-hmm. university to come back to us, because with regard to the governor's budget request, and we've had bills here about Alzheimer's, we've had bills about the spinal cord, and so we've asked the university to get back to us with mm-hmm. their priorities. If they did get that money, what do they prioritize? And so I understand that question. Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think you've touched a somewhat on my follow-up, because Dr. Toler, I sympathize with you, but it doesn't seem like, at least in the outset, that the university leadership is necessarily making you as big a priority as you'd like to be. And if they, you know, it should be the university telling us that regenerative medicine is a priority to them. And that's the only place I'm coming from. I think you're doing great work. I just want to know that you know, we're not, I don't want the legislature to be a vehicle for programs that don't get funded through the normal cycle to then come to us and ask for special appropriation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I respect your opinion. I think you are right. You know, I am fiercely loyal to University of Minnesota, to Minnesota. Yes, my ambition is to make it the magnet for talent, you know, from all over the United States. And I do know that we do have a support from the president, from the dean, you know, from the leadership of the university.
Thank you.
And just as a follow-up for the members, we'll make sure to get that list from the university before we act on our final bill. Thank you. Very good. Well, Senator Sieben, thank you so much for bringing this forward. Dr. Toler, thank you for being with us, and thank you for your wonderful and important life-saving work.
Madam Chair, member, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Next. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. Senator Sharon,
653. Just pull that over.
Thank you very much, Senator. If you would like me to begin.
Yes.
Thank you for taking time to hear Senate File 653. I'd like to begin by offering an A1 amendment.
And members, we have it. Very good.
It should be in your packet.
Right. And Senator Sharon offers the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much. Just to explain, it's simply a language change that uses a different term, Southern Minnesota Center for Agriculture, rather than the Farm Business Management Program, and it better articulates the integrated approach that's being used to move forward the concept of ag to vet. So with that, I'll just move back to the bill itself. I really appreciate the time that you're giving to this bill. I want to introduce Mike McLaughlin, who is with the U.S. Marine Corps. He's a veterans advocate who is here to testify to you today. Brad Schlosser, who is the dean of the Southern Minnesota Center for Agriculture. The amendment refers to the Southern Minnesota Center for Agriculture. And Dr. Annette Parker, who is the president of the South Central MNSCU system in the North Mankato area. The subject of the coordination of this particular request. And I would invite them to speak to you and to answer your questions. So Senate File 653, which is articulated as the Veterans to Agricultural Program Appropriation, is a bill that proposes to establish a pilot program that would support the entrance of veterans into careers that are related to agriculture and food production, processing, and distribution throughout an intensive academic training, job development, and outreach to employers. This program would do all of those things plus some career building skills for vets. It appropriates $150 million in those numbers are always shocking to me. $150 million in 2016 and
$150,000.
Is that what you're asking for? Well, we can do this.
Senator Sharon, I was thinking that.
We can do this.
It's just what I was thinking.
I mean, we can just send a collection. Oh, that's not enough. We'll talk about this. So $150,000.
You asked for more the next year. You asked for more the next
and
year.
$600,000 in 2017. The project would be coordinated with the Southern Minnesota Center of Agriculture. That's the amendment that we just made in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, University of Minnesota's Extension, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I would just note here that if you take a look at the fiscal note, the collaboration, the coordination initiatives from these various groups have been absorbed by their organizations. South Central College's Southern Minnesota Center for Agriculture would be responsible for delivering the program to 5 additional state colleges, one of which must be located in the metropolitan area. The funds will be used for program design, especially in the first year, its development and coordination, curriculum development, instruction, student supports and counseling, and marketing and recruitment. A maximum of 2% of the funds can be used for the administrative purposes. And for your reference, page 11 of the fiscal note addresses how those administrative dollars would be spent. It's estimated that approximately 15 to 25 veterans will be participating in the first year of the program and approximately 150 in the second year. This bill would benefit the underemployed and unemployed veterans in their transition back to civilian life and offer them a long-term career path.
Excuse me, Senator Sharon, it's yes. Actually page 9. Numbers are following along.
Okay.
Of the fiscal.
Excuse me.
That's
page
right.
Nine.
Thank
page
you.
Page 9. Thank you. So here then to explain the value of this program to you as committee members, I'd like to allow my testifiers, there may be an order in which they would like to introduce themselves, and I'll allow them to do that.
Very good.
Senator Sharon, thank you very much, Senator Bonoff, Chair, and committee members, appreciate it. I would like to make note to the chairwoman, these discussions are pretty similar to what we've engaged in with Pipeline conversations. The agricultural industry, of which we are all appreciating on a daily basis, probably 3 times or more a day, it's all about providing food. and sustenance.
And would you introduce yourself for the tape?
Excuse me. Yes, yeah. Brad Slusher, and I am the dean for the Southern Minnesota Center of Agriculture. I also work in a collaborative role for the Minnesota State College University system. I serve as academic dean for agriculture and farm business management for South Central College and also with Minnesota West Community Technical Institutions. So,
and thank you for your work on the pipeline project.
Pleasure. Thank you. And I would like to share my testimony here on behalf of Senate File 653, and thank you for the opportunity. South Central College is poised to provide workforce development and education in the industry of agriculture. 2 years ago, our institution was granted the opportunity to support the Southern Minnesota Center for Agriculture. And we have a long established history of providing quality ag-related education to the citizens that are interested in the agricultural field here in our state. Faculty are committed to educating agricultural entrepreneurs and employees for agribusinesses to help in rural communities so that they remain strong and thrive amongst our rich resources that we have available. We have an agribusiness program at South Central College. We have a farm business management education program, strong and growing. Enrollments in the agribusiness program at South Central have doubled in the last 10 years. Farm business management educators work with over 540 farm families in South Central Minnesota, providing for them management education. The same happens in seven other institutions around the state of Minnesota at our technical and community colleges. Establishment in 2012, our Minnesota Center of Excellence in Agriculture with the mission of specifically aligning students with the resources of academic institutions and industry to develop and sustain the workforce needs of agriculture in southern Minnesota. And this really is all about that. We have a positive history of serving veterans to agriculture and the industry opportunities. I've had the pleasure and the privilege of teaching agriculture at the secondary level for 7 years. Another 20 years at the post-secondary level, specifically at South Central College. And today I support, as the dean of the Southern Minnesota Center of Agriculture, these programs, and have had the pleasure of working with students that are veterans and have shared their stories, and fortunately, they are entering into the industry of agriculture. Would certainly like to see more opportunity provided, so really committed to that. In Southern Minnesota, we are sustained by agriculture. This is a gift that I'm committed to continuing supporting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And while Mike is getting the microphone, the reason I referred to 11, page 11, is that there's a clearer articulation on that page of how those, the design and operation of the appropriate amounts that I wanted to draw your attention to. I'm used to making one mistake per presentation, but two was...
You know, Senator Stern, we might have different versions.
Okay, well, I'll let me look again and... And I'll look through this again. I'll show you what it is I'm referring
to.
And we can look at it again when we're looking at the omnibus bill. But just to make sure people understand how it's...
Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. Thanks for giving me a few moments to speak on behalf of Senate File 653. I promise I will be brief. I believe my parking meter expires at 4 o'clock, so I anticipate as much testimony as happened here today.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, no problem. As stated, I am a United States Marine Corps veteran. I did deploy twice in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom. I do work as a veterans advocate today, and at one point I was a student veteran at Minnesota State. And for a period of time, I was an unemployed veteran post-graduation. And the latter two are why I'm here today supporting this bill, is because that's what I see 653 as. In rural agricultural Minnesota, it's a jobs bill. It helps put our men and women who fought on the front lines for us back to work. And, you know, I would point out a phrase in the bill that sticks out to me, highlighting, you know, the transition ability, if that's even a word. I guess I'm not as part of academia as everyone up here. So, but on 1.16, what really stands out in my mind is 4 to 8 week academic training and relevant fields of study, job development programs, and outreach to potential employers, and appropriate career building skills designed to assist returning veterans in entering the civilian workforce. Now, I started MSU in the spring semester of 2008. And I probably personally wouldn't have chose to go the four-year route. My wife was pretty persuasive on ensuring that I use the education benefits that were available to me. And being a good Marine, when the general tells you to attack the hill, you really don't ask why. So,
smart.
Yeah, self-preservation, I think, too, as well. So. And there was a lot of people from various backgrounds, various different skill sets of the military that were transitioning the same time I was. And I watched a genuine struggle for a lot of men and women who the four-year route or the two-year route wasn't theirs. And there is kind of a lack of that, utilizing the skills that are already there and inherent in them to get them into the workforce. And I think it behooves us as a community and as a state to help fast-track those service members, and it's a pretty common term, bring them all the way home and get them back into civilian society and get them working and being productive members of the community, not only for the community's sake, but for themselves and for their families, and because they deserve it, because they put things on hold to serve us and protect what we have every day. And so, you know, I think it's pretty well documented in the news and in most reports that most of you probably see the employment issues that's already inherent in the veteran population and the unemployment rates. I work with student veterans and those transitioning from unemployment or from school to employment. And so the need is still very real. And I think to offer up another opportunity or another avenue to take advantage of those skills that they have, the veterans who served as mechanics, motor T, construction trades, engineers, there's a very real real need for those skills in the agricultural field out there, and it could be an easy transition. And with that, I'll end my testimony. I just ask you, please support this, and let's help serve those that served us.
Mr. McLaughlin, thank you for your service. You know, really very moving and inspiring. So thank you.
Thank you. Also, Senator Bonhoeff, and I don't think Senator Nelson is here, but I think that Mr. McLaughlin was speaking to her issue, which is there is a need in this area, and this is specifically combines two needs, the vets to ag and also the needs for drawing more and more of our students into thinking about agriculture as a is an area of skill that is really needed and has been underserved for a long time. And I'd like to conclude then with Dr. Parker, although I want you also to know that Santo Cruz from the Department of Agriculture is here to answer questions if you would like, but I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Annette Parker.
Thank you, Dr. Parker. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoeff and members of the committee. First, I'd like to let you know that South Central College is a yellow ribbon college. And that means we know how to serve veterans, and we believe that we do that well. Secondly, when you come into Southern Minnesota, as you know, and around South Central College, both our Faribault and our North Mankato campus, what you see is corn, soy, food production as a basis, even in manufacturing and our mechanical programs as well. In those programs, we cannot employ enough students to your earlier discussion with House Senate Bill 2. And so we really feel that this is a bill that we can take the Southern Minnesota Center for Agriculture and mentor other MINSCU institutions about how to ramp up and get students into the ag production and in the agriculture industry into well-paid jobs. And so I, too, would ask you to support this bill.
Thank you. Dr. Parker, I know we've made some progress around giving veterans credit for prior learning. Can you share the status of that? What do you do at your institution?
Well, what we do, actually Minnesota is leading the nation in how we award credit to veterans. And so we're expanding on that work, actually, with the Charting the Future plans that we have right now. I'm actually the convener for competency certification and credit for prior learning. And so we'll be able to expand on that work to recognize actually learning experiences of veterans and others going
that's
forward.
That's outstanding. Thank you. And we'd like to be apprised of how that's going, so we'll make sure to circle back and check back in with you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff. That concludes our presentation, and you're correct. In the fiscal note that you have in the packets, it's different than the fiscal note, but the same information is on your page 9 is on my page 11.
Thank you. Yeah. So any other questions? Anybody else want to testify on behalf of Senate File 653 as amended? We appreciate Deputy Commissioner Santo for being here. Very good. So with that, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
We're relieved it's not $150
million. It would have been way too much in the second half of the year. So.
Right. Thank you. But
this is certainly a doable number, right, Senator Bonner?
Yeah. Okay. Last bill before Minsky budget, Senator Torres-Ray. And thank you to all those who are being so patient waiting for the Minsky budget. We really appreciate it. And for those of you who didn't hear, we are planning to stay over, so we're not going to just end at 4. So.
Chair and members, I'm really thankful for this opportunity, Madam Chair, to present this bill, and I think you are more familiar. We met in your office with a group of outstanding individuals who support this program. But I am really proud, members, to introduce you to my intern, Kaya Schaefer, who has been working in my office, and she actually wanted to come and work with Madam Chair. And she tried both, and then she made a decision. And it was hard for us to make
these decisions. We've forgiven you.
Thank you.
You remember, members, we didn't have a lot of space to house a lot of interns this year, so it became very difficult. But I think what became so important for me with this experience, we typically have 2 or 3 interns in our office. But what happened this year with Ms. Schaefer was that she was able to really bring a perspective of a student who really struggled to figure out how was she going to come here and complete some of the credits that she had to complete for her program and complete this internship and leave her job in order to do this and be able to afford to stay in school. So she was confronted with that. I had no idea that she found the solution through this program at Metro State. And so as we got closer and we worked on figuring out how was she able to finance her internship here in our office, she told me about this incredible program that exists at Metro State University that is administered by the Institute for Community Engagement and Scholarship Program at the Metropolitan State University, and they receive some funding from the federal government that makes this possible, and they pay very little to the students. But what is so remarkable about this program, Madam Chair, members, is that they receive $150,000, and they are able to provide internships for about 30 students each year. And I was just like, wow, this is a tremendous amount of impact with very little money. So that is what really motivated me, Madam Chair and members, to really come before you to present this idea. I believe very strongly that we need to expand this program and that we need to have the state participating in funding this program. What became really much more evident as I met with the representatives from the university is that they have a waiting list of double the number, and they are not able to offer this opportunity to the students because they really don't have the funding to do that. As you know, Madam Chair and members, it is incredible how now internships have become the norm in so many places that we are hiring from those interns that come to work for us. Many of the interns that have been here have been hired to work in the different offices, and nonprofits are doing that almost all the time, that they want students to be interns and really get to know them, get to teach them, train them, and then they get hired. So really the norm about hiring people has become that you have to be an intern first. So I think that these internship opportunities are incredibly important, and I would like to introduce you to my testifiers so that they can talk about her experience and also the university's really desire to help us build this program. And this is available in other campuses, in other programs. The idea, Madam Chair, here was to start with this very little money and this opportunity to really get to know how the state could participate in this and perhaps over time learn how it works and how we can expand this program to open opportunities for more students.
Thank you.
So for the record, my name is Kaya Schaefer. I'll tell you a little bit about me. I am a fifth-year undergrad. That is because prior to this year, I had been working full-time. Therefore, I had to go to school part-time. So in order to speed up that process, I had to do things in order to get through school faster. Anyhow, that required me to take on more than a full-time course load. Now, in my last and final semester here, I've had to take on this extra responsibility of an internship, which is great. You get a lot of learning and a lot of skills, job skills. We talk about opportunity gaps, skills gaps, all sorts of things. And having an internship really, really, really helps alleviate a lot of that. Anyhow, at my college, Metropolitan State, I was able to utilize the Great Lakes Grant. What that does for me is it pays me $10 an hour, and this has allowed me to be able to work here without taking on more than what's literally possible for my schedule, and it allows me to work here and really get the full experience. If I wouldn't have had this funding, I'm not sure I would have been able to be here, but then also I'm not sure I would have been able to graduate either. In fact, I know I wouldn't have been able to graduate because it's a requirement of my program. So in a nutshell, that's my testimony, and I really, really hope that you support this bill because I know so many students that are in similar situations and weren't able to utilize this funding. So,
congratulations, and you are going to graduate?
Yes, I am, in May.
That's great. Good work.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Greg Mellis, and I'm the Director of Community Engagement at Metropolitan State University. Delighted to be here today at the invitation of Senator Torres-Ray for the discussion of Senate File 1766. For Metro State, community engagement is at the heart of our organizational and educational philosophies. Our founding president, David Sweet, noted in 1971 when the university was established that the entire metropolitan region would be our campus. He envisioned that learning would take place at sites and locations across the region, and the university would draw on that vast knowledge and resources found throughout the metropolitan area to educate our students. To this day, experiential learning and applied learning strategies are deeply embedded in our academic programs and courses, and those courses are held at four primary campuses and dozens of instructional sites across the Twin Cities. In addition to providing students with opportunities to apply learning within real-world contexts, academic community engagement is a principal mechanism by which the university partners with businesses, small and large, nonprofits, public sector, and community-based agencies to contribute to the regional agenda for economic growth and prosperity. These relationships keep our academic programs close to the industries for which they prepare students and ensure that our curricula adapt to meet the rapidly changing needs of the workplace in a knowledge-based economy. Principal among those strategies for academic community engagement are student internships. The widely understood benefits of internships have been shown to include the development of valuable workplace skills, increased employment rates, and career exploration and development for new or displaced workers. Studies have shown that as many as 65% of interns receive full-time job offers from their employers. Yet the reality is that there are also costs associated with internships, which prevent many students from pursuing the opportunity and experiencing their benefits. At Metro State, the vast majority of our students are adult workers who juggle job responsibilities with family obligations while moving in and out of their academic pursuit to obtain a college degree. For these students, the prospect of taking time from paid employment to pursue an internship is not viable. The reality is compounded by the fact that many, if not most, internship opportunities in the marketplace today are unpaid. At Metro State, for every one student who secures a paid internship, seven students complete an unpaid internship. To address this problem, the university pursued a competitive grant award through the Great Lakes Loan Guarantee Corporation under their Career Ready Internship Grant Program. Our proposal was accepted, and we were awarded $150,000 to support paid student internships. We were the only Minsky University to receive an award. Additional information on the Career Ready Internship Program can be made available to the committee. Through these funds, the university will support 107 students this year alone in new paid academic internships and in existing internships, which were formerly unpaid but now have been converted to paid internships. We've worked closely with the Eastside Area Business Association in the vicinity of our St. Paul campus to assure that small businesses and entrepreneurs were provided the resources to support and access and host paid interns through this program, and that our students might learn firsthand about the challenges and skills needed to sustain and grow a small business. This grant is a one-year award, and the university will pursue the opportunity for another round of funding support through this program in the upcoming academic year. At Metro State, the majority of internships are completed in the nonprofit field, and these agencies are rarely in a position to compensate their interns. The university will continue to pursue support through our fundraising and grant solicitation to provide direct compensation to students. We know that students who complete internships persist and complete at rates greater than their peers, that internships generate credit for applied learning, which accelerates students to degree completion, and that internships open a host of career development and employment opportunities to students. However, these opportunities often remain elusive to those from communities who have historically accessed less opportunity. We appreciate the interest that Senator Torres-Ray and this committee have taken in our efforts to compensate our student interns, and we welcome the opportunity to pilot a paid internship model and to report to this committee on outcomes related to persistence, completion, and employment within students' selected fields of study. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be delighted to answer or respond to any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we also have a handout that it has some very interesting information about, you know, the number of students and the number of hours and the placement of the students. If
we can, we have that,
distribute right? That for the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Torres-Ray. Senator Torres-Ray, your bill does not talk about reporting back to the legislature.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to incorporate some language. I know we talk about this, and we had some back and forth kind of conversations as to what language needs to be included in here. Part of the issue, as you remember, is that we wanted to use this opportunity to really look at what we can learn in terms of the investment document that, and perhaps bring that for the future. So I will be more than happy to work on some language with the staff to incorporate some reporting mechanism to put some information in place for the committee.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. So we can do that as we, you know, bring the bill back if it's included in the final omnibus bill. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you.
And I must say that my legislative assistant, Sean Oyes, was my intern. And I hired him from watching his outstanding work as an intern. And prior to that, John Eichten was my intern, and I hired him. And so I certainly have experienced what you're speaking of. So any other questions for Senator Torres-Ray? Thank you very much for bringing this forward. Thank you for your work, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I very much hope that you're able to support this pilot project and see if we can expand it in the future. Thanks for your consideration.
So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. So with that, we will move to the Minsky presentation. So those who are testifying first, if you would join us at the table.
Thank you.
Chancellor, nice to see you here. Trustee Coles, good to see you.
Chair Bonoff.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. I'll make opening remarks at your request.
Great.
Very good. Chair Bonoff, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. My name is Jay Coles, and I serve as the Vice Chair of the Finance and Facilities Committee of the Minsky Board of Trustees. Beside me is our Chancellor, Stephen Rosenstone. I'm joined by other trustee colleagues on the board, Don Erlinson. Bob Hoffman was also here earlier but needed to leave. And we're also joined here in the room by student association leaders, bargaining unit leaders, and you're going to hear from them briefly, but I'd like to acknowledge the presidents of our universities and colleges who made the trip here this afternoon. If they could stand for just a moment. Thank you very much.
And you can, they're welcome to say their names.
Please.
Thank you very much.
Scott Olson, Winona State University.
Thank you.
Leslie McFellin, Rochester Community and Technical College.
Thanks for being here.
Joyce Esther, Normandale Community College.
Thanks for being here.
And, of course, you heard earlier from Dr. Annette Parker as well in earlier testimony this afternoon. We appreciate the time to address the committee today. We are encouraged by the high priority of higher education in the biennial budget process. And we're deeply grateful that in his revised budget, Governor Dayton has recommended our full $142 million request to cover inflationary costs and a tuition freeze. Today, we're asking you to consider our request. You've asked us to be very brief, so we'll touch on only three topics: some key facts that frame our request, what our request makes possible, and what full funding means both to the students and communities we serve. And we're going to work from the PowerPoint presentation that I think each of you has, rather than raise the screen and fiddle with the AV system. I'll turn it now over to Chancellor Rosenstone.
Thank you. Chancellor Rosenstone.
Trustee Coles, thank you, and Chair Bonoff, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here today. We want to be respectful of the time constraints the committee is facing.
And Chancellor Rosenstone, just so you know, don't feel like you have to hurry. That we're happy to be here. That's why we asked. If you wanted to have all your testifiers, we would just do you there on the agenda, and so take your time.
We appreciate that, and we will respect some time constraints. But I want to share with you the facts that inform our request. Slide four before you, the first fact we want to remind the committee of is that we serve all Minnesotans. Minsky has the largest and most diverse student body in the state. This year we serve 410,000 students at our 31 colleges and universities, nearly 6 out of 10 of all the undergraduates in the state of Minnesota. They attend one of our campuses. When I say all Minnesotans, I mean all Minnesotans in every corner of the state. But that also includes over 52,000 first-generation students, 62,000 students of color and American Indian students, 99,000 low-income Pell-eligible students, and over 11,000 veterans this year. And it's important to note that in each of these categories, we serve more students than all the other higher education providers in the state of Minnesota combined. Fact two on slide five, Minnesota's cut to higher education has been deeper than the national trends. The blue line is the national decline in public higher education funding. Over this time period, it's down 29% since 1999. The red line is Minnesota, and at the same time, the nation saw a 29% cut in its funding in higher education. Minnesota cut funding by 53%. This is not a Minsky line. This is all funding of all higher education in Minnesota. So this means, in short, that 16 years ago, Minnesota's higher education appropriation per student was about 21% higher than the national average. It's now about 20% below the national average. Now, we expect that when we have the national data for the last 2 years in hand, we'll be able to see that some of that gap has closed as a result of the important investments that the Senate, the House, and the governor made in the last biennium. The third fact is also, I think, a familiar one to members of this committee. The cost of educating a Minscu student has not increased, but what's happened is that the cost of who pays that increase, who pays the cost, has shifted from the state of Minnesota to our students. Back in 2002, the state provided a little over 66% of the cost of a student's education. Today, that share is a little under 44%. State support of our colleges and universities, as I mentioned, did increase significantly in the last biennium, and we're very grateful to you, to the House, and to Governor Dayton for that support. But even the recent boost in state support funding per FYE means that we're still about 32% below where we were back in 2002 in inflation-adjusted dollars. Again, the key thing to understand is that the cost of an education has not gone up. It's who pays the cost that's shifted over these years. And as state support has been reduced, tuition went up, and it rose by about a third to about 60% of the total. But it's also important to note that our students did not make up the entire loss of state support. We took deep budget cuts on all of our college and university campuses, and our faculty and administrators took 3 years of hard salary freezes to help protect affordability and balance those budgets. What we're asking you to consider, the proposal that the board has brought forward to the legislature this year, is to look at what happens to the right of that vertical line on that graph, and that is to move us to a 50-50 financing plan, where between the biennium we're about to enter and the biennium that will come after the next biennium, we will get back to 50% being paid for by the state of Minnesota and 50% being paid for by our students. If we get on that path, and that's what our request is about, is getting on that path, we will, by the end of the biennium that ends in 2017, be back to about 47.5% of the total being paid for by the state, the rest being paid for by our students. The approach enables us to hold tuition down while maintaining and protecting access to high-quality, high-value education across the state. The fourth fact that informs our request is that Minscu basically has only two primary sources of revenue, state support and tuition. And the reality is that both state funding and tuition are needed to support our faculty, staff, and physical plant. We need both to cover costs. Our universities and colleges dedicate 75% of their budget to pay our dedicated faculty and staff, and those costs are determined largely by collective bargaining agreements, which cover roughly 95% of all of our employment, all of our employees. The last fact that informs our request is on slide 8. It's fact number 5. Overall administrative spending by our colleges, universities, and the system office is among the lowest in the nation. The red bar on the right, that's us, we rank 38th out of 50 states in the District of Columbia in administrative spending per student. This is one of those lists, Senator Bonhoeff, where you want to be near the bottom, not near the top, and we're very proud to be near the bottom of this list. And if we were to take out only the system office and look at its spending, its base budget is 24% smaller than it was in 2009 in nominal dollars. And 60% of all the money spent in the system office is spent on IT to support our students and our campuses, including their registration systems, online courseware, and course management. The formal request is summarized for you on slide 9. Our request is for $142 million to allow our colleges and universities to provide a very modest compensation increase and to cover the inflationary increase of the cost of our operations. Our request will allow the Board of Trustees to freeze tuition at the 2012-2013 levels for 2 more years, benefiting 264,000 students in the state who take courses each year for credit. $142 million provides only enough to cover inflation. Our colleges and universities will take responsibility and will use internal resources to cover all other costs and new investments. Finally, Chair Bonhoeff, members of the committee, our request will allow us to first protect programs on our campuses so we can continue to serve students and meet the workforce needs of Minnesota. Secondly, our request will protect our ability to actually deliver these programs to make sure we have the faculty and staff and IT specialists and advisors in place to serve our students. And last and certainly not least, this proposal protects affordability. It ensures access for all Minnesotans. We arrived at this request through a lot of consultation with our presidents, with all of our bargaining units, with both student associations, and of course with our Board of Trustees. Consultation that determined what resources are needed to meet our commitments to Minnesota. We'd like to conclude our testimony by giving you a chance to hear directly from our campuses. And I'm pleased to introduce to my left President Sue Collins from the Northeast Higher Education District. President Collins.
President Collins, welcome. We've visited you in your territory, so it's nice to see you here. Thank you.
Yes, and Chair Bonoff, committee members, I thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. As the Chancellor indicated, my name is Sue Collins. I serve as President of the Northeast Higher Education District, a consortium of 5 colleges on 6 campuses covering 13,000 square miles of rural Northeast Minnesota geography. Our colleges, as you know, represent the engine that drives workforce development in our region, and world-class technical education is what we strive to deliver for our region's businesses and industries. But over the course of my 7-year tenure as president, we have experienced a $5 million reduction in appropriation, and now a dramatic enrollment drop due to the decline in our regional high school populations that translates into diminishing tuition revenues. I wrote to Governor Dayton, and I thanked him for his recommendation of $142 million, and I sit before you today to ask this committee for that same level of support. The level of funding would mean that we would avoid an additional $4.8 million in cuts over the biennium at NEHED. Without that funding, we cannot continue to be the engine that our communities expect us to be. We are truly at a crossroads. We have one administrator at Vermilion, one chief administrator between Itasca and Hibbing, and one chief administrator between Rainy River and Mesabi Range. During the time of my presidency, we have reduced 100 positions. We are in deficit spending to balance FY15 budgets, and we will be there again in FY16 without the relief that the board's $142 million request would bring to us. We have 2 colleges in financial recovery plans because of our financial fragility. And I predict that all 5 colleges will be in that same situation in FY16 without your help. With all humility and respect, I offer to you that rural colleges matter to Minnesota. They matter to rural economies, like the economies that we have on the Iron Range. The story of my college's needs is the same story for the other colleges and universities across the system. And so, Chair Bonoff, members of this committee, please, I ask you, don't ask me to cut my way out of the present circumstance, because I can't. Our students deserve the very best that we can deliver. Please help me. Help me maintain the high-quality student experience that our faculty provide, as well as the technical programming that our communities that we serve really need. And please, as I step down as president this summer, please give the next president of the Northeast Higher Education District a fighting chance to protect access to higher education across the Iron Range. Thank you.
Thank you. President Collins, how much of your situation in your particular district is impacted by declining enrollment?
Chair Bonoff, committee members, we have lost the equivalent of 900 FYE, which is approximately $4.5 to $5 million.
When you've listened to testimony today about the Senator Stumpf bill and perhaps even Senator Sharon's bill, and I, I know you're familiar with the pipeline project bill. Do you think that holds hope for turning that around?
Chair Bonoff and committee members, I believe the bill that you're referring to has great promise for students who are pursuing technical education.
President Collins, so for example, Vermilion, wouldn't that fit that?
Chair Bonoff, committee members, the bill would apply to all of our colleges, yeah, all of our technical programs.
Okay. So I just raised that because it occurs to me that if, in fact, as we suspect that doing the Stumpf bill would actually spur enrollment, that may also alleviate some of the budget concerns. Senator Kent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that same line of questionings, Ms. Collins, you had mentioned that a portion of this was related to declining high school population. Can you, within the declining enrollment side of this, how much of that is about the smaller universe of high school graduates versus the rebounding economy, for example, and people choosing to do things other than pursue higher education?
Chair Bonoff,
President Collins,
Senator Kent, committee members, I'm sorry, I don't have specific information about that, but I sat with our superintendents of late, and they've talked about the declining high school populations and the impact that it's having on them. So I would say it's a mix of those two circumstances.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff, for your permission, we'd like to use the rest of our time to let you hear from the people who make up Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, did you
have a question for this presentation?
Oh,
which could come
President
back,
Collins, or? Could you just sit for one more moment?
Thank you,
Senator
so
Nelson.
Oh, it's just on page 5. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. And Chancellor, you talked about that. Key fact number 2, which is, I guess, page 3, but slide 5. Minnesota higher education cuts are deeper than the national average. And so I was looking at that line, and, of course, we never like that when Minnesota is trailing nationally. And so I took off my glasses here, and I was just trying to read exactly what this is measuring, because the number doesn't really ring a bell. And what I thought I read was that it's the appropriations per public FTE. And I just want to know exactly what that means.
Senator Bonoff, Senator Nelson, be happy to clarify. This is all spending for higher education in the state per full-time equivalent student in a public institution. So it's normalizing for the number of students that are occurring in each institution over time, added up across the entire state. And it's in constant dollars.
Okay.
So at a time when we need to be more than ever before the brain power state in the nation, we have made deeper cuts in higher education than most other states in the nation. We have gone from being 20% ahead of the rest of the nation in terms of the investment we've made in higher education to being a state that's now 20% behind the rest of the nation in the total investments we have made in higher education.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson.
So we don't want to be behind because this is Minsku is the workforce developers of our state, which I understand. But if you look at the per public dollars per FTE, so it's a numerator and a denominator, correct? So wouldn't it be so if the denominator increases? So is it full time equivalent of the student?
Yes.
Not this. I'm sorry. I was thinking it was. You know, I'm a former teacher. I think full-time educator, FTE. You're talking about full-time students.
Senator Bonoff, Senator Nelson, absolutely correct, and I apologize for that ambiguity. So over time, states have changed the number of students we're serving. We want to correct for that so that we're not looking like we're better because we got fewer students or worse because we have more students.
Thank you. This is that clarifies.
And then also, Chancellor Rosenstone, when Ms. Shoemaker gave her presentation, she talked about that Minsku being the third highest on the cost side in the country. So can you address that?
Senator Bonoff, be pleased to. I want to make sure we're using the same words the same way. It's not that we're higher in cost. It's higher in who's paying the cost. So Ms. Schoonmaker's reference is to the tuition that our students pay as opposed to the proportion of the cost that the state pays. And so that's reflected, if you will, both on slide 5 and on slide 6.
Okay. Senator Nelson?
Oh, thank you. Just
and
a
Senator
brief
Sharon
question. It's just so wonderful to have the people at the testifying table that have the answers that we seek. So thank you for your indulgence here. So, you know, one of the things that we've been really interested in is co-requisite courses. I know Senator Clausen's talked about that as well. And one of the things that concerns me is that of the kids who take the ACT, those are our college-looking kids, only 40% of them are college ready. That's a, and I know that's an issue that we need to deal with in the K-12 system. But my question is, do you have an idea about what percent of your full-time educators or hours are devoted to remedial education?
Yes.
That's what I'd like to know.
Just give me one second.
Yes.
I have the actual fact in my hand. I just got to find a piece of paper. But small enough that I'm going to have to wince a bit. I apologize for that. At our colleges in 2014, 8.4% of all the courses taken were for remedial. That is lower than it was in 2011 when it was 9.4%. So part of what we've been doing is the collaboration that the legislature and the governor helped create in the world's greatest workforce legislation 2 years ago to do a better job aligning with K-12 and have more students prepared for post-secondary so that fewer students need remedial education when they get to us is the path that we've been on. We've discovered, and we know this a lot from the very innovative work being done by our faculty both at Normandale and MCTC, which are the two that I know the best about, that the co-requisite approach works for about the top quarter of the students with respect to underpreparedness. But it's not one size that fits all. And we have a huge diversity in the kind of students we're serving. Remember, our average student is 26 years old. She may be coming back to higher education after having been out of school for 5, 6, 8 years or more. And one size of co-requisite will not work for all of our students. And so we are working hard to make sure that we're moving students through developmental much faster. But we got to do it in a way that's hand-tailored to the needs of those students. And our faculty have been very innovative in making sure they're matching the right path for each of our students.
Okay, and okay. We need to move on. Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I appreciate this presentation. And I remember the first year that I ran for the legislature, I think, let me look at your numbers here, how long ago that was. We were really struggling. We were just beginning to go below the 50% level. And at that time, our goal was to get back to this percentage that you're describing. And now I see that your goal is to get back to about a 50-50 state share to capturing the remaining costs from tuition. And even though that really means that burden is it's not that the cost of education is increasing, but the burden is placed more on the family's capacity to be able to achieve that, and that's why our state grant program is so important. And I'm really glad that you gave us an overview at the size and the number of students and who it is that we're serving in the MNSCU system, and that we have to have that in front of us all the time when we talk about where we're investing our money and where the future for our capacity to meet the needs for the workforce in the future is going to come from. And so I'm really appreciative to those things. But I would like you to talk a little bit about a couple of things. First of all, I'd like to see the state have a higher percentage of responsibility than 50-50, but I understand that we need to incrementally move towards that. Besides the enrollment figures that you're talking about, which in fact impact how much tuition you're able to gather, the volume of students and their payment of tuition helps defray the costs of the system. And when your enrollment goes down, of course, you're using some of that revenue source. I understand that, and I understand that's happening, and I think partially driven by the economy. So I don't know how these other initiatives that we're talking about really change the fact that there's more employment opportunity now where there was not employment opportunity before, and that drives a lot of people into skill development and changing careers. And I think that is a huge factor here, that the volume of students goes up and down also with the economy. and that if the numbers of students simply graduating from high school and the economy continues to have good employability, that we need to think about that in terms of the long-term capacity to support education. In healthcare, during a downturn, we have more and more people who meet the criteria because they're unemployed to be eligible for our public programs. So the budgetary demands are huge on the state. But as people become employed and, again, do not meet their criteria, the demands on our budget go down, and so then we end up having a budget surplus, which is a lot of what we have this year. So I'm just making that comment because I think about the long term, what impacts our capacity to sustain the MNSCU system or our higher education system has to do with the volume of students who are there to go and those who are not employed, satisfactorily employed. And we have to think about that in terms of our ability to support the costs. I'm just curious if you think about that long-term, those components that impact your capacity to sustain the system long-term.
Senator Sharon, your point is very well taken. The two biggest predictors of our enrollment are, as you note, the economy, not just the number of high school graduates in the state. And we're countercyclical with the economy. When the economy is in rough shape, as it was 2008 through 2011, roughly, our enrollment soared because more people substituted education for work, and those that were out of work came back to our colleges and universities to retool. But the state did not provide us any additional funds to serve those students. We found a way to do it. And now we're taking responsibility for adjusting to those students being back at work, either because they graduated or because they're finding work that they couldn't find before with the skills they now have. And with 3.6% unemployment, a lot more people are at work than at our colleges and universities. And that's glorious for the state of Minnesota, but it's produced some challenges for our colleges and universities. The way we think about this request in the context of the very important question you're raising is we have to protect the programs that are necessary to make sure that the manufacturing firms in the Mankato area, the agricultural firms in southwest Minnesota, the Iron Range firms up in northeast Minnesota are going to get the people they need in order to continue to grow. And if we don't have the programs in place to do that, if we don't have the faculty and staff and technology specialists in place to do that, we will not be able to sustain the growth of communities around the state of Minnesota. So as we think about the long run, we're not coming to you with a list of nice things that would be fun to do, or wouldn't it be nice if we could. We're coming to you with the fundamental basics of protecting those programs and protecting the ability of those campuses to meet the workforce needs of Minnesota and protect the people there to get that done. So when we think about the long term, I was listening as I was coming over to Steve Hines' testimony earlier today. We're going to have a workforce shortage in this state because the population just isn't growing. And if we're relying so much on tuition that we don't have tuition enough to keep the doors open of those technical programs or the doors open of our universities, the state of Minnesota is going to be in trouble. And so we're there today saying we need help to protect those campuses, those programs, the personnel necessary to deliver the kind of education that you and communities across the state and businesses across the state are counting on us to deliver. That's the emergency that we're confronting.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, thank you for the information and the key facts. Do we have a statistic on how MNSCU, how the cost of tuition, MNSCU tuition compares to other states?
Chancellor.
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Miller, I don't have that in front of me because the answer to that is going to be adding up across all our colleges and universities as apples versus oranges, and we'd also want to subtract off the incredibly generous state grant program we have here to find out what the real net costs to our students are. What I can tell you is that there is no more affordable higher education in the state of Minnesota than our colleges and universities. And in the case of our technical colleges and community colleges, it's by a factor of 5 to 6 compared to the other alternatives, the for-profits or the privates that exist in the state of Minnesota. With respect to our universities, the cost of tuition is, in round numbers, about 55% of what it is at the University of Minnesota and somewhere between 1/5 and 1/6 of what it is at the private universities.
the ultimate cost to the student, the price that the student's going to pay, is a function of two factors: how much support the state's going to provide for the student, and a factor of what the state grant is. And those are things that all have to be factored in to answer your question more precisely.
Chancellor Rosenstone, on slide 5, I would ask that if you could get back to us to include, and I understand you may not have the national data for the last 2 years, but we know what the state did provide.
Yes.
So if you could have that graph go out those 2 years. In addition, if you could add to that the state grant dollars that that flow to Minsku, just so that when we look at what the state ends up giving, that we see actually what the state ends up providing.
Chair Bonoff will be happy to update the red line, but please understand the red line includes the state grant.
Oh, it does.
This is not a Minsku slide. This is the totality of the state's investment in all of higher education in the state of Minnesota.
So, Chancellor Rosenstone, you're certain that that red line includes the dollars as they flow?
Yes.
Through the student? That doesn't count in tuition?
No.
That counts
this
as
is just state
appropriation?
Exactly. This is just state support.
Okay,
that's why
you.
This slide, Senator Bonoff members, is so alarming.
Okay. And we know we course corrected 2 years, the last 2 years,
indeed,
so we'd like
we
to see that.
We appreciate that.
Thank you.
So if I could step aside and
Great.
We invite those that are coming from our colleges and universities to share with you the impact of our
Thank
request.
You. Go ahead, Ms. Shoemaker.
Hello again, Chair Bonoff, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kaylee Schoonmaker, and I am the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. I also wanted to let you know that I'm a student at Century College and St. Paul College, and I intend to graduate from Itasca Community College, so figure that out. And I am here today on behalf of nearly 200,000 students to support the funding requested in the Minsku budget request. Students at our two-year colleges do pay the third highest tuition and fees in the country, as we've already heard a few times today. We're thankful that the costs facing our students have caught the attention of decision makers on all levels, and we want to thank Governor Dayton for his recommendation of full funding for the Minsku budget request. For many students, myself included, adoption of the governor's recommendation for Minsku will be another 2 years of protection from increased tuition costs. For students who are right on the edge of being able to afford college, it will allow them to start or continue their education and training and perhaps even take more credits than they otherwise would have. Our state's economic future will depend on our ability to provide access to an affordable education for all Minnesotans. With the growing need for well-trained workers in a variety of sectors all across the state, access to affordable community and technical colleges will become even more crucial. Our community and technical colleges reach every corner of this state, from International Falls down to Red Wing, Granite Falls, and they're producing workers that provide for the local and regional economy as well. Students who attend our institutions are the nurses in our nursing homes, the mechanics repairing our farm machinery, the technicians who operate and maintain our technology infrastructure, the teachers that teach our children, and the list goes on. If students can't access the programs offered at these institutions, the economy in many parts of Minnesota will suffer. So I want to thank you again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schoonmaker. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Bonoff and committee members, for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Carrie Cooper, and I serve as the State Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, MSUSA, and I am a student at Bemidji State University. I'm here today to stress the importance of affordable tuition. I want to say a huge thank you for the historic investment and tuition freeze Minnesota State College and University students have experienced over the last 2 years. This has made a big difference to our students and state universities by keeping debt levels down while ensuring quality remains high. We hope you will continue those efforts and fully fund Minsky's request of $142 million for another two-year tuition freeze. $142 million is what the Minsky system needs to sustain the quality and affordable higher education that it provides to Minnesota students. The tuition freeze ensures that an additional financial burden is not placed on our students, and an investment of $142 million will ensure that more than 400,000 students in the Minsky system continue to have access to affordable education. The average debt level of a 2013 Minnesota University graduate was $30,894. As a student, this crippling debt is a personal issue for me. I currently owe $48,000 in student loans for my undergraduate bachelor's degree. This is $48,000 after my scholarships, after my part-time jobs, and after my parents contributed as much as they could. This is true for many other college students in Minnesota. There are even more students out there who do not receive scholarships, do not have families that can help them out, and are having to push back their graduation date so they can work full-time to pay for school. These are the students that I represent. These students chose to stay in Minnesota and attend Minnesota State schools, and they are struggling to get the valuable education that can lead them to a successful and rewarding career. These students are the future leaders of our state, and right now they need the state to invest in their education. Thank you so much for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. Cooper. Can you share with us, what is your major?
I am getting a bachelor's of arts in liberal studies and a minor in mass communication.
And do you know what you want to do after?
Yep, I want to work in the nonprofit sector.
Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonoff and committee members. My name is June Clark, and I am president of AFSCME, and I represent the staff at all our two-year and four-year universities. And I also am a very proud employee of Minnesota State Community and Technical College, also known as M-State. M-State has campuses in Detroit Lakes, Fergus Falls, Moorhead, Wadena, and we also have an online e-campus program. My position at the college is admitting students to the college's nursing programs. M-State prepares students who are beginning their nursing careers or who want to continue their professional nursing education. Because of the shortage of nurses, a large healthcare system that provides services in Minnesota and surrounding states is offering a sponsorship to students so that they may earn their practical nursing degree. M-State has made changes to their practical nursing program so students can now earn their degree in two semesters. Upon completion of the program, students are prepared for licensure as practical nurses and for careers in long-term care, acute care, and ambulatory care facilities. Through partnerships and programs like these, M-State is helping to respond to the demand for nurses in Minnesota's healthcare industry and throughout the region. We are responding to the citizens of Minnesota who need quality health care. I would like to thank Governor Dayton for his full support of the Minsky biennial budget request of $142 million, and I also would like to thank you for your consideration of the request as well, and I stand for questions.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Tim Besky. I'm an employee of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm located at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall. Unbeknownst to me, my campus president is also here today. I'm the vice chair of the MAPE Meet and Confer Committee with the Minsky System Office. At the request of the System Office, we participate today in requesting your support for funding for the $142 million. The people who I work with as part of Minnesota Association of Professional Employees do a variety of jobs, some of which include facilities coordinators, sign language interpreters, psychologists, web programmers, and beyond just web programmers, we've heard the phrase today, information technology and information technology specialists. A good share of our Minnesota Association of Professional Employees fit that category. one of the things that's happening with a good economy is that it's hard to retain qualified people to operate the systems that connect all of Minsku. We're here to request your support for the $142 million. It is through the work of our people that students are able to participate in classes online, participate in classes on campus, and so forth. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Looks you have your next group. Very good. And while, thank you, we're making this transition. Members and those who are here probably have seen the Senate target. So we did not have the same target that the governor had, but the Senate did have a $205 million target in terms of a added increase to the base spending for higher ed.
Chair Bonoff, committee members, thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Adam Klepitar, and I'm here representing the Minnesota State University Association of Administrative Service Faculty, and we're also members of Teamsters Local 320. And I'm here representing over 800 administrative service faculty from Minsku Universities. I'm also the director of First Year and Transition Programs at St. Cloud State University. In this role, I am honored and also humbled to work with all of the students as they begin their lives in our universities. This population of students that we interact with range from honor students to provisionally admitted students. This puts my colleagues and I into a position where we work with all of the people that interact with students across our institutions. I know that many of you have visited our great campuses and realize that I work with people that help students accomplish amazing things every day. We are able to identify and remove barriers for our students, not only academically, but also by helping them afford college, pursue dreams in work and in their communities, and create the Minnesota that we all want to work in, live in, and raise our children in. $142 million helps us to keep tuition affordable, to continue to be able to clear and create pathways for student success, and to do our part to create the Minnesota that I've always been proud to call my home. I want to take this opportunity to thank Governor Dayton for fully supporting our request of $142 million and let you know that the MUSAF stands with Chancellor Rosenstone, the Board of Trustees, the other unions, and most importantly, our students, in our support of the $142 million. And thank you, and I'm happy to stand for questions as well.
Thank you.
Chair Bonoff, Senators, my name is Jim Grabowska. I serve as the president of the Interfaculty Organization, representing nearly 4,000 faculty of the state universities. I'm also in my 17th year as a professor of Spanish and World Language Education at Minnesota State Mankato. As you heard earlier, the Chancellor mentioned nearly six out of 10, or 58% of undergraduates in Minnesota are being taught in a Minsku State University classroom like those at Minnesota State Mankato. And as a faculty member, and speaking on behalf of my state university colleagues, the IFO stands firmly in support of the Minsku budget request. Now, you may be asking, what is the return on a $142 million investment? The answer is simple. First, you're investing in proven programs on all of our campuses. Minsku's request includes the resources our campuses need to continue providing an education that meets the high expectations of employers, families, and students. Secondly, you'll be investing in protecting our ability to deliver these programs. If the Minsku request is underfunded, students will find it harder to complete their degrees. Underfunding will increase class sizes, reduce course offerings, and it negatively impacts quality. The return is an investment in accessibility and affordability for all of our students. $142 million freezes tuition for 2 years without negative impacts to quality. That's a small price to pay to continue the investment from the last biennium, which was a great first step in addressing student debt without sacrificing quality. A full-time university student enrolled as a freshman in the fall of 2012 would save $2,050 over 4 years with a continued tuition freeze. Reducing the burden on all students will undoubtedly lead to students taking on less debt, focusing more on their time on attaining their degree, and then moving into the workforce. This is a goal that we all share. The IFO is proud to speak in favor of the Minsky budget request.
Mr. Grabowska.
Yes, ma'am.
We have had many conversations around this table about strategies that would also reduce the cost for students, and we've identified how important it is that they graduate with as much speed as possible, and that is why you've heard the discussions around this table around looking at the co-requisite model, around looking at the some of the best practices that Complete College America brought forward with regard to the guided pathway structure. I wonder if you could say anything about, you know, the completion rates for the four-year institutions. The four-year rate is I believe it was 23%.
Madam Chair, I cannot speak directly to those percentages across the universities. I did have a discussion last night with the provost of Minnesota State, Mankato, as I was preparing my remarks. It wasn't specifically about the graduation rates. It did, however, talk about the Complete College America ideas, because by and large, I have some issues with some of those. But where we did happen to coincide, and my invitation to the members of the committee would be to visit the Minnesota State Mankato webpage. And on that webpage, you can find the academic plans, which are advocated by Complete College America. All of the colleges at Minnesota State Mankato, and I know that at other institutions, the other four-year institutions are engaging in strategic planning as well, you can find documents that talk about and address those concerns very specifically, college by college, program by program. On the webpage that I mentioned, you will see executive summaries so that you can find out the plans and purposes of the different programs within the colleges. You can see the vehicles that they are using to try and accommodate those issues that we embrace, and the methods that they are having to use right now in order to preserve the programs that they have. So while I can't answer your question directly, I can provide you or point you in a direction in which you may be able to find that information.
Thank you. Mr. Lindstrom.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Kevin Lindstrom. I'm the president of the Minnesota State College faculty. I'm also a counselor at Anoka Technical College, and I am a product of the MinSCU system, having earned both my undergraduate and graduate degrees at what was then Morehead State University. Go Dragons. I'd like to begin with a couple of thank yous. First of all, to the governor for his budget proposal for the system, and also to all of you for your careful consideration of this very important matter. It's been my privilege for the last 25 years to watch students at Anoka Tech as they pursued their lifelong goal. Some of those students were down to their last chance, and they were looking to the college as a way to find a path to a better life. Some of those students had their lives disrupted, maybe through a layoff from a career they'd been in for years, and they were looking for a path to a better life. And some folks were just simply looking for a way to move up, and they came to our college to find a path to a better life. And I saw success story after success story after success story in that vein. We know that access is the key to finding that path to a better life for our students. We know that affordability is the key to access. And you've heard a lot here today about affordability and cost and price and those types of things. I think it is critically important to note that there is a distinction between price and cost. The cost of the delivering education in our system has been well contained, and I think you've heard data about that. From the faculty perspective, I would point out that the latest IPEDS data shows that our two-year college faculty average salary is below the national average for two-year college faculty in public settings. So this is not necessarily just about cost, it's about that price, and that's the part that you control. And as it relates to everything I've spoken about here today, I would ask that for the sake of affordability, which creates access, which creates the opportunity for a better life for our students, that you fully fund the system's budget request. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you've created a compelling case today. Thank you very much to all those who presented. The schedule for the next week or so is that we will be putting together our omnibus bill. It's our intention to have it before the committee next Tuesday. At that time, we'll take testimony, we'll take amendments, and if possible, we'll vote on the bill that day. If not, we'll come back and do it the next day. So with that, there's no further business before the committee. The committee is adjourned.